Hello and welcome to this special edition of NJ Biz Conversations. I'm your host, Jeff Kanige. My guest today will be a familiar figure to NJ Biz readers and to New Jerseyans in general. He's the CEO of Hackensack Meridian Health, Robert Garrett. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate you having me.
Oh, well, thanks for taking the time. I know you're just back or recently returned from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and I want to talk a lot about that. But first, I was hoping you could give us a little bit of a public health update on what's going on with COVID. We've seen a lot of reports from wastewater studies and other sources suggesting that cases are climbing at a fairly alarming rate. I know HMH back in the fall reinstituted some mask mandates. What are you seeing now around the state? What is your staff experiencing in general around New Jersey at this point?
Well, Jeff, we did see certainly an increase in cases and in hospitalizations starting around Thanksgiving time and continued right through the Christmas holidays. And in the month of January, toward the middle to the end of January, we saw that stabilize quite a bit. And actually, the cases are currently down from their peaks. So that's good news. We probably peaked at about 350 hospitalizations across the network, and we're down probably in the low 200s right now as we speak. We've also seen a decrease in team members that are out of work as a result of COVID. That's always an indicator that hospitalizations are soon to follow. So obviously, we'll continue to track some of the variants that are out there. I know there are some new ones that the CDC has reported are prevalent. So our Center for Discovery and Innovation continues to track them, and we're ready. And our mask mandate is very flexible, but it's based on science and based on prevalence rates and on team members that are out of work and number of hospitalizations. So there is some variability from hospital to hospital, but certainly team members that come in contact with COVID patients or directly face patients are still taking the appropriate precautions.
Okay. Well, I guess you asked, my next question was going to be, how are things, how do you see the rest of the winter playing out, given what we know about vaccination rates and things like that, and the way people are behaving? Not many people are wearing masks out in the grocery stores or doing that anymore. What is the outlook at this point? Do you expect the cases to continue to decline?
I think we're going to probably, what we've learned over the last few years is that there is some, short-term declines, and then usually it's a period of stabilization, and then depending on the variant and depending on vaccine rates, it pops up again. Given the low vaccination rates and given the fact that variants are still present, new variants are, my guess is that we'll see some decline. I think we'll probably see some additional spikes, particularly around gatherings. And, I think in the springtime, I'm sure with some of the, the holiday gatherings, and then in the summertime as well, as people kind of come out of their homes and, and spend more time with one another, we're going to continually see these peaks and valleys. But overall, I see a pretty stable outlook compared to where we were, a year ago, and certainly much more stable than 2 years ago.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good. And just one final thing on this whole issue. It's also flu season, and now we're told we need to worry about RSV. What, in terms of respiratory distress in general, how is this season shaping up?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing significant flu cases that they started again in November and slowly were climbing. I would say right now I wouldn't say there's a decline, but I think there's a little bit of stabilization there. And RSV, has risen gradually over since the start of winter. What we are seeing though is, some severe flu and some severe RSV cases, but not a huge number of those cases. Most of them are coming in through our emergency department and are treated and released. There are some that result in hospitalization, but not as many as COVID patients.
All right. And do you get the sense that folks are getting their flu shots and their RSV shots and taking care of that? Is that still happening?
I would say definitely their flu shots. I think the uptake on RSV shots is still a little bit on the low side, and I think that's because it's new, and we still do much more public education and public awareness about RSV and about the new vaccines. But definitely, we've seen a good response on flu shots amongst our team members. We're almost 100% in compliance.
Cool. Okay. All right. Well, that's actually a much more positive report than I was expecting. So that's all good
Oh, that's
news.
good. That's good. Yeah. Well, I mean, if we had this 3 weeks ago, we're still going up a bit. Might have been a different story, but as we speak today, things definitely seem a little more stable.
Okay, very good. Okay, so on Davos, now you're a regular participant. You've been there
Yes.
before. This year, as I understand it, though, you had a somewhat different role. You were named and trying to. It's the chair of the Health and Healthcare Governors Community. Did I get that title
That's
right?
right. That's right. Yes,
So,
yes.
okay, so what is that, and what was your role, and how is it different this year?
Well, you're right. I've been going for several years to Davos. I think this was my fifth World Economic Forum that I attended. I started attending actually pre-COVID. So what I was appointed to this year, and it's a 2-year term, is to be the chair of the health and healthcare community, the World Economic Forum community. And what that role really entails is helping to set the agenda for our health and healthcare priorities and to really organize a steering committee that can help me set that agenda so that we have some really good interactive but focused meetings amongst the governance group in Davos. So this year we did that. I started in the role really in the fall. We got our steering committee together, which is made up of sector CEOs. It could be healthcare providers, could be device company CEOs, pharmaceutical CEOs, as well as getting input from policymakers like health ministers from around the world. So we had a series of meetings at Davos under the governance community. And we decided through the steering committee process this year that artificial intelligence was going to be our main focus. And that, by the way, that was the themes throughout Davos, not just in healthcare, but in the other sectors as well. The themes really are revolved around AI and trust, and really the intersection of the two as well. So for healthcare, what we decided to do was to look at our four healthcare priorities through the lens of artificial intelligence. So the four major pillars, if you will, in terms of the priorities were increasing access to healthcare around the globe, closing some of the disparities that exist in terms of health equity issues around the globe as well. The third pillar was improving value, improving outcomes for health and healthcare. And the fourth was climate change's impact on health and healthcare. So those four pillars were looked at through the lens of artificial intelligence and how could artificial intelligence help us achieve some of the goals under those four priority areas.
Okay, well, AI is certainly the topic du jour. I mean, almost every meeting I have, every meeting I go to, someone wants to talk about AI. Now, I know, and you wrote an article for the World Economic Forum on this on AI. So, can you tell us a little bit about each of those things? How does AI fit into what you're talking about? And what were those discussions like when you were in Davos and you were talking about those, as you put it, those four pillars?
Right. So first of all, you couldn't go probably 2 feet in Davos without hearing about AI. It was everywhere. I mean, from Bill Gates talking about it to world leaders talking about it to us in the healthcare community talking about it. And it's obviously has a profound impact on the financial institutions, on energy, the energy sector, as well as education and healthcare. So, in terms of those four pillars and what we spoke about is we let me give you the format of how
Well.
it happened, and then I can get into some of the specifics. So the format was that we assembled a panel of experts to talk about those four areas and how AI might impact those areas. And And also, frankly, what are some of the safeguards that we have to put in place to make sure that AI is deployed safely and accurately, and that information, particularly patient information, isn't compromised? So we start, starting with, and so starting on the health panel, we had CEOs of device companies, pharmaceutical companies, and then one major health system, Mayo Clinic. The CEO of the Mayo Clinic was on that panel. And we talked about individual use cases in each of their companies in terms of how AI is really powering advances. So as an example, in the area of expanding healthcare access, there's no doubt that AI can connect patients and communities, if you will, with health and healthcare providers like never before, particularly in underserved areas, through information, through algorithms that can really provide better health information to those communities. So there was a lot of discussion around health access and how we safely deploy AI to improve access to healthcare. With respect to health equity, if you think about it, there's such a disparity depending on whether you're in a so-called developed country or underdeveloped country. The life expectancy can vary up to 30 years depending on where you live. So the idea was, how can we deploy artificial intelligence to close some of those health equity gaps? So as an example, one of the use cases that we have going at Hackensack Meridian Health is to identify advanced kidney disease earlier on, which disproportionately impacts minority communities. And with that identification or detection of disease earlier on, clinicians can either prevent the onset or slow it down, and could save years of dialysis that a patient might have to encounter, and even put off, if you will, on complete kidney failure. So that's just one example of where AI detecting disease earlier can have a profound impact on health equity. The third area was value and outcome improvement. In the way of value, I have to tell you, there's a lot of AI use cases, whether it's enabling radiologists to prioritize scans for those patients that might have a problematic diagnosis. AI can not only take a look, with an intense focus on the scan itself, the radiological scan, but actually can aggregate a lot of the patient data around that scan so that everything is being looked at one time. It can tell the radiologist that might be reading 150 or 200 scans a day, say, okay, let's prioritize these three or four because these look like they need immediate attention, and then a treatment plan can happen. Another use case out there for improving value or improving outcomes is in the way of OR optimization. So a lot of times there are holes in the operating room schedule, cancellations happen, and through AI algorithms, you can really fill in those holes with surgical procedures where families or patients might be waiting a long time for that procedure. Get them in earlier. It's better for their care. It lowers the length of stay. So it really has some great impact. There was one children's hospital that we talked about. I think it was in Arizona, that was actually using artificial intelligence and algorithm to detect malnutrition in children that were previously missed. And I think they were picking up 7, 8, maybe 10 children a week with that had malnutrition that they didn't pick up before. So there's a lot in the way of value and outcome improvement. Then in the way of climate change, also climate change's impact on health and healthcare, a lot of great use cases out there, but certainly through AI, we can predict dramatic climatic events like the one we had this summer where the smoke came down from Canada and caused havoc in our emergency departments. Through AI, some events like that can be predicted, so you can prepare a little bit better. It also can help us in terms of our own energy consumption and our own carbon emissions in terms of reducing them, because healthcare, unfortunately, is one of the contributing factors to climate change as well, healthcare organizations in general. So there were a lot of use cases that were on that panel. Following that panel, Jeff, We had a discussion amongst the group, the governors themselves. Then we invited the health ministers from around the globe to come in and get their perspective on AI and healthcare. And they included the health minister from Brazil, included the health minister from India, the head of the Institute of Medicine in the U.S., and Dr. Tedros, who is the head of the World Health Organization. Great discussion. Talked about regulations, talked about how there needs to be a private public partnership to really develop regulatory tools. And there was a realization also that the technology is changing so quickly that the regulations could never keep up with that. So that's why it's important that the private sector, if you will, the providers and the drug makers and the device makers have to work hand in glove with the regulators. So, and then once that ended, everybody got back together again in terms of the governance group and came out, broke into groups and came out with an agenda moving forward and an action plan moving forward. So it was really a good session.
Okay, and I do want to hear about the action plan and what's going to happen in the future. But you gave us a lot to unpack there, and mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to the use of AI and how and you say you're and I have no reason to doubt this. I'm sure you are using it at HMH now, and probably it's being used in many other contexts
yes.
around the country, around the world. How does it work? I mean, what I use AI for in the form of ChatGPT is its ability to digest a huge amount of information and give you back a fairly focused answer. So in the case of, as you first described, detection of kidney disease, I think you said, or kidney disorders, how does that work? Because don't you need a lot of information that may not be available for that? How does AI help you there?
Well, because what it can do is aggregate information from the patient record, so the clinicians really have a lot of information that maybe was in different places, wasn't readily available or accessible. So, you know, when patients are screened, they will, AI algorithm can really kind of pull in, if you will, all that data, all that information, and come up with some suggestions or ideas. And, you know, let me also, you know, reassure, you know, everybody who's watching or listening to this that, you know, there's human intervention all the way through. So nothing, we're not talking about, you know, a car that drives itself or a plane that flies itself. This is in healthcare. It's important that any of these use case pilots that are going on have humans that monitor it, make sure that the information, they test the information to make sure it's accurate, that again, that privacy is protected, and that ultimately the decision to use that information is being made by a human being. You know, most in the case that we're talking about with, you know, advanced kidney disease, it's obviously a nephrologist or another type or different types of kidney specialists are going to make the final decision. So we're not at that point where, you know, it's totally okay. This is how patients are being diagnosed. It's a tool to be used by clinicians, but there's no doubt it can be a very powerful tool, and it's a great technology if it's used the right way in a healthcare setting to really advance our goals.
Okay. So what I hear you saying is that it really is that sort of core function of being able to analyze a really large data set very quickly that human beings can't do. So it's that base case for the use of it.
It absolutely can. And, you know, again, you know, and you know, even the folks that have been on the forefront of generative AI, you know, and they were there in Davos as well, people like Sam Altman. I mean, you know, you have to be careful. You got to make sure that everything is accurate. You know, they call it, you know, sometimes information hallucinations that come out of some of these algorithms. So, you know, I think as time goes on, that the technology will get better and better. But you got to make sure that it's, you know, certainly it's accurate. We're talking about, you know, life and death situations sometimes. So that's why I want to emphasize that human beings are involved every step along the way. But having said that, you know, like as an example, that imaging example I gave you, I think the number is like 96% of the time the radiologist is agreeing with the after reviewing the data and the information is agreeing with the AI algorithm. So that's, you know, that's a high percentage. And, you know, but you also want that human being to be there for that other 4%, right? Where they don't agree, so that they're doing the right thing.
Okay. Well, I imagine Sam Altman must have been like a rock star working through Davos.
He was, and he's certainly been through a lot, you know, up and down a little bit, but he was certainly very interesting, as they say, a person of interest there. And, you know, obviously, you know, people like Sam Altman there, and then you have on the, you know, on the policy side, you have folks like world leaders like President Zelensky from Ukraine. And, you know, just it's you know, it's you go from one to the next, and it's some very recognizable faces for sure.
Right. Okay, you mentioned some of the pitfalls, guardrails that need to be erected. What were the discussions around those subjects like? What is the main concern that folks have about the use of AI and what needs to be sort of corralled, if that's the right word for it?
Well, I think in healthcare, it's two things. Number one is making sure that the information is accurate, particularly if it's going to be used, you know, on the clinical side. I mean, that's really important. And even if it's being used just to enhance productivity, you want to make sure that it's doing the right job. If it's taking some functions or making a person, a team member's job a little bit more easy because they can get the information quicker. You just got to make sure that that information is accurate, it's reliable. But also the other safeguard, I think, in healthcare is making sure that patient records are protected. So, you know, as these algorithms are put in place and information is assembled, you want to make sure that it, you know, the information stays confidential, and that, you know, no HIPAA violations occur, and that, you know, things are you know, handled that way. I have to say that the policymakers from around the globe were really looking to the industry to help guide them in terms of these safeguards and these regulations, because, as I said, the technology is probably changing much quicker than they could ever write regulations about. And that's been the approach in the U.S. too. President Biden signed an executive order late in 2023, which kind of set out some guidelines for a public-private partnership to develop the right safeguards for AI in healthcare. And you know, there are many organizations like Hackensack Meridian have been participating in that process. So, you know, I was happy to hear that the policymakers weren't trying to you know, impose regulations necessarily, but really wanted to work with the industry, because we both want the same thing. We want the same protections out there, whether you're a healthcare provider, or you're a policymaker or an elected official. You want to do the right thing, and you want to make sure people's lives are protected, but you also don't want to slow down the innovation that goes on. So you don't want arbitrary regulations that actually stifle the development of these advances, because they could literally transform healthcare moving forward.
Right. Well, I was actually just going to ask you about the White House, and because I do remember that they had a whole event around signing of the executive order and a conference, and I was curious as to whether your group and you and Hackensack have had contact with the administration about that.
We have had some contact with the administration about it, and as I said, we will be participating in that process, especially as we move forward. So, you know, I think the executive order gave a good framework for these kinds of discussions and dialogue, and there really wasn't any objection to that approach, whether it was from the Minister of India or Brazil, or from the World Health Organization. Everybody agreed that this needs to be a collaborative partnership. This is new for everybody, and we got to work together to put the right types of guidelines or safeguards in place.
Okay, so it sounds like there was a consensus about where you're going to go and how you're going to get there. Is that an accurate
I
reading
think
of?
that is absolutely accurate. You know, and you know, I think there was, like I said, I probably can't give you the details of what came out, because that is a, you know, proprietary product of the World Economic Forum. But I can tell you there was consensus about and you know, I think the document's going to talk about ways that we can utilize AI to further our health and healthcare goals, but also to make sure that we engender trust amongst providers, like physicians and nurses, amongst patients and healthcare consumers, and amongst policymakers and elected officials. So those were kind of the actual action plan will have elements of those categories involved.
All right. Now, you mentioned a bunch of different areas in which your AI can be used and was being used. I think I read in your it must have been in the piece you wrote. You also listed things, everything from diagnostics to drug development, staffing, and identifying social determinants and things like that. Those things are happening now. Yes.
Yeah, so they are happening now in use case, what we call use case pilots. So they are happening to one extent or another. And, you know, it's important that we, you know, we demonstrate that, you know, that it can, that there's reliability, that we can deploy this safely. And that's why there are many pilots going on. And I think, you know, most healthcare organizations, at least big health systems like Hackensack Meridian are engaged in these pilots and making sure that they can, that they work and that they're safe. So, yeah, so it is being used now, but certainly the potential is to use it a lot more widely and universally as these pilots mature.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned sort of, I'm guessing everybody had some homework that they have to do. So what's the next steps? What does the next several months look like for the group that you're chairing now? And how do you take the discussions that happened in Davos and put them into practice, into action?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I made it very clear as the chair that I want to do just that. I'm not waiting for next year's Davos to pick this up again. We already have our steering committee that's being scheduled. We're going to have meetings every month, and we're going to try to get the governors, the community, the entire healthcare community back a couple of times during the year as well. It's hard, you know, with folks' schedule. Obviously, Davos is where they all converge, and you know, it's easier to have those discussions. But we're gonna make every effort to do that. So we're gonna take what came out of Davos, what came out of those discussions, the document that was produced, and we're going to continue having those discussions with the steering committee in terms of ways that we can, you know, deploy and make the start to take some definitive actions. And then I'm hoping, you know, sometime in the middle of the year we can get the full community back together and have some additional discussions about not only where we are from Davos to that point, but where we're going to be going and making sure that the full board community endorses it.
Okay, well, that's because that in any of these sorts of things, you wonder how it goes from the discussion level, which is fine to be talking about it, to actually doing the kinds of things that you're talking about that AI can actually accomplish with the protections that everyone seems to want.
Yes.
How does that have? Is it really just a function of keeping people focused on the issue and to keep the discussions going until the technology catches up? I mean, how does it? What's
yeah? I think it does. I mean, you as the chair, I mean, I feel like that's one of my major roles is to keep the focus on it, keep the discussion going, keeping it alive. I mean, I remember last year, 2023 at Davos, you know, I signed the Zero Gap pledge for health equity, and we had some meetings during the year where we were all asked to update the group on our progress that we're making toward that, and we actually had a session this Davos to 1 year later, you know, what's happened on that zero pledge gap, and you know, I was able to talk about all the people that were screening for the social determinants of health and all the referrals that we're making and the data that we're collecting on that. So, you know, it's important that it's not just something that's said in, you know, in Switzerland once a year that there is progress being made, because otherwise we're really not gonna achieve our objectives.
Okay. Well, you actually anticipated my next question, which was about that very issue, health equity. When we spoke last year after Davos, much of the discussion was focused on that question and that issue. And as you said, it looked like it continues to be a discussion, a focus of the discussion in Davos. What and you did mention the Zero Gap pledge. what has been the progress? What can you give us a little bit of an update on what you're doing now and how, if at all, the situation has improved?
So, I think, from our perspective at Hackensack Romania, let me start that, look, I could talk a little bit more, what I heard out in Davos from others. I think a lot of progress has been made. So, if you think about it, we've screened over 1 million individuals. We've made 3.5 million referrals for people to get help. We've also looked at the data and said, okay, what has kind of jumped to the top of the list, based on those screenings. And, the two issues I think that have jumped to the top have been food and food insecurities. And the second issue has been really lack of behavioral health, access to behavioral health care services. So, what I'm really proud of is that, we took that data and we took action on it. So as an example, on the food and the food insecurity issue, we partnered with grocery stores around the state and instituted a fresh match program where we supplemented the benefits on the SNAP cards that people are received so that they are incentivized to eat fresh fruits and vegetables. And I'm really, really heartened to recognize that the grocery stores really from around the state have really been stepping up and really anxious to participate in that process. So that's a, an example of, an action we took based on the screening from the social determinants of health. And I think that is starting, over time we'll see data, but we are starting to hear the feedback that, people are taking advantage of that and will be hopefully buying more fruits and vegetables and eating healthier. And that will make a difference in terms of their overall, health status. With respect to behavioral health, again, we saw that jump to the top. And, we in these past few months, we opened up additional beds at Raritan Bay Medical Center in Perth Amboy, which is, one of the areas that are underserved, that we did see that the data pointed to a lack of behavioral health care services. So that was a good success story. We opened 81 beds there in Raritan Bay. We also saw that there was a lack of access to pediatric and adolescent behavioral health beds. So we're in the process of adding additional beds at the Carrier Clinic, pediatric and adolescent beds there. So I think this data is very powerful from the screenings. So we're not only, referring people for kind of immediate help, but then we Hackensack Meridian Health are taking some strategic actions to help the situation. And we'll continue to refine the data. We're having it kind of sliced and diced, if you will, along demographic lines and along racial and ethnic lines, so we can really hone in on, very, very specific strategies. And, I can say this in the session at Davos, the follow-up session to the zero health equity gap pledge, people reported similar progress from around the table. And, those are folks that represented different segments around the globe. But folks did, have done, different things in terms of their own healthcare organizations. But, it's good because you can share some best practices. But I can say that certainly I think people have made progress on the social determinants of health. I think we're going to have to see over time how much progress is actually made in terms of measuring it. But certainly it isn't from lack of folks taking initiatives out there. I think they're, I was very impressed with a lot of the reports from, not just Hackensack Meridian, but from our colleagues out there.
Okay. Now, yeah, and you did mention climate change. You talked a lot about climate change. In New Jersey is particularly vulnerable in some respects. I'm wondering how, if you're seeing that vulnerability now sort of show up in what you're dealing with. Is it showing up in food insecurity? Is it showing up in the kinds of disorders, of illnesses that you're seeing? How is it manifesting itself now, if at all?
Well, I think it's,
what you're seeing in
New Jersey, yeah. I mean, I definitely, there's no doubt in my mind that, it is manifesting itself. I mean, we're seeing, higher incidence of respiratory illness, higher incidence, of asthma cases coming into our emergency departments. the infectious disease department is telling me, and our CDI is telling me that, you know, there are viruses that, you know, are that you know, folks haven't seen, that have been kind of dormant, that, you know, are starting to kind of rear their ugly head, so to speak. And so I think we're going to see over time, of course, more of that. Now, you know, one thing, you know, that we've seen in other parts of the globe that we haven't seen here is, you know, increased cases of malaria and things of that nature. But I do believe, you know, even some of the malnutrition rates that, you know, that you're starting to see kind of go up a bit, even in New Jersey, may be related to climate change. But I think some of that probably won't manifest itself for you know, for some years. But in other parts of the world, absolutely. I mean, you know, as the temperatures have gone up, as the climate has warmed, in terms of access to food, to fruits and vegetables, and even in terms of how it's impacted farming, is definitely having an impact on health and healthcare.
Okay. I do want to talk a little bit about what's going on at HMH, but I don't want to move off of World Economic Forum. If there's something else, I mean, is there other takeaways from what you heard or the people you talked to that you'd like to share?
I mean, I did participate in a panel on racial equality, and they wanted to get my perspective from, you know, the healthcare perspective, and, you know, and I think certainly there's been, you know, inequities in access to healthcare for many years, probably due to conscious or unconscious bias. And so, you know, talked a little bit about that, talked about what we were doing. So I think that was an important subject as well. And I did participate in some other artificial intelligence panels outside of the governance community. The only other takeaway, you know, I would give you is certainly the geopolitical issues out there are significant, with, you know, with wars raging in the Middle East and in Ukraine, and, you know, other conflict areas, and, you know, that certainly will have an impact on people's health and well-being as well. So, you know, I think that was another takeaway, and we did hear from many world leaders in terms of their perspective on the global geopolitical situation. I mean, one statistic that was pretty striking was that I think 40 countries in 2024 are going to have major elections around the globe, which could have a profound impact on, you know, on anything from, you know, the economy to education, and certainly to healthcare as well.
Right. Well, including this one. So we've got.
Well, they said, you know, out of the 40, this one, I think, is one that people were paying most attention to.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned the racial inequality question. The last time we spoke, I believe, was last spring, when Hackensack Meridian was ranked first in the country for your DEI program by Diversity Inc. I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit more about how that program is going as it continued to improve, and what's the latest?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, let me start with a distressing statistic out there, not at HMH, but in general. I think, and this may be related to the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, but in the last couple of years, I think the statistic is 18% of American businesses that may have made a commitment to DE&I have backed off that commitment. And you know, I've been outspoken about the fact that this is the time to double down. It's not the time to back off at all. I think we've made some great progress. You know, certainly I'm grateful for that number one ranking, but that's really because of the hard work of our team, not just the DE&I team, but the entire culture, the entire health network. So one of the areas that I think have been, you know, a measure of our success is the work that our team member resource groups are doing. We have 11 what we call TMRGs, team member resource groups, that are active, that represent different groups out there, and they're making a real difference. You know, they're transforming our culture. They're making some great recommendations to help promote equity within HMH, and even in terms of the benefits that we offer. So a couple examples are, our Black team member resource group made a recommendation that we cover doula services as part of the birthing process. And actually, there was just a bill that went through the New Jersey legislature on that as well. So as a result of their recommendation, we did cover the doula services, and no, so that will help not just the African American population of HMH, but really helps everybody. So, when these groups get, when they get focused and they make a recommendation, I always say all boats rise. Our Pride group made a recommendation to increase in vitro fertilization benefits within Hackensack Meridian Health, and we took a look at it, and they had a good point. I think we were maybe a little bit lower than we should have been, so we increased the IVF benefits as well. Again, all boats rise. It's not just for that particular group, but that's for all of our team members. So I think, I think the TMRGs, these team member resource groups, have been a measure of our success. We've also increased our spend, our diversity spend in terms of minority-owned businesses. So we're proud that that's going in the right direction. And then we continue to look at our leadership and our board and making sure that, they reflect the communities that we serve. And we have several leadership development programs that really are a great pipeline for minority groups to get ahead in leadership. And I just attended one of the graduations, and I'll tell you what a great group of young people coming up, and future generation of leaders at Hackensack Meridian Health. I was really excited to see it. It's excited to see the enthusiasm, and those are just Jeff, a couple examples of, I think, where DEI is stronger than ever. And I'll repeat, this is the time to double down, not the time to back off.
Well, that's and the reason I asked that question was precisely because of that, because of what we're seeing, the sort of, for lack of a better term, the backlash against DE&I that
Yes.
being in some quarters. You mentioned some companies pulling back on it. I imagine in part that's because there are some states that are governments that are requiring the elimination of those sorts of things. But what I hear you saying is that that's, I mean, first of all, are you aware, have you felt any of that, number one? And then the second question was going to be, what is your commitment the same? It sounds like it is. But to the first question, I mean, do you get any pressure about this?
Do not. I don't get any pressure, here in New Jersey amongst, elected officials, policymakers, my own board. Everybody has been very, very supportive of our efforts. So I don't get any pressure to back off at all. And I would say to the folks out there, listen, if there's obviously, I would never ask anybody to in other states to go against the law or the regulations, but I think sometimes, that they could be used, kind of as an excuse too. And I think it's important that within the regulations, within the law, to continue on this path. First of all, it's the right thing to do, but secondly, it's the right thing for companies from an economic perspective, because the studies out there are pretty compelling. More revenue comes to those companies in the way of innovation from innovation. Those that have that practice DE&I and have a diverse workforce, even in terms of EBITDA, that drops to the bottom line. Companies who have diverse leadership teams, are more profitable. So it's the right thing to do, just from a societal perspective, and from an ethics perspective, but it's also good business.
Right, and that research is longstanding. I mean, it's it, you would think it would be much more widely known than it is. But
Yes.
okay, we only have a few more minutes. I wanted to run through a couple of things very quickly if I could get your reaction to them. First of all, this year, U.S. News and World Report ranked Hackensack University Medical Center as the best hospital in New Jersey, dethroning Morristown Medical Center for the first time in 5 years. What does that mean to you? What does it mean to the staff? What does it mean to HMH?
Well, what it means is it's a recognition of the hard work and the outcomes that are produced at Hackensack University Medical Center. So if you take apart, you peel back the onion of U.S. News and World Report, what is that? It's about mortality. It's about complication rates. It's about are there enough nurses at the bedside? Is the length of stay the right way? Are patients engaged and satisfied? So a bunch of different metrics out there. So I can't be more proud of the folks at Hackensack and really around the network for trying to achieve the very best. And, you know, to make that list is an honor in itself. To be number one in New Jersey, the number one adult and children's hospital, is really, you know, really reflective of the outcomes. The team has just done a tremendous job. And, you know, listen, there are great hospitals throughout New Jersey. And, you know, I commend others that that have achieved great outcomes as well. I mean, that's great for our state. I mean, the more, you know, the higher we achieve, whether it's U.S. News and World Report or other, you know, measures out there, that's great for the people of New Jersey.
Okay. And just a quick update, if you could, on a few things, a few areas that are fairly recent developments, the opening of the John Thurer Cancer Center, your medical school, and just today we had a story about the ALS Center at Jersey Shore. What's the latest on those three?
Well, I mean, as far as the John Thurer Cancer Center, we are, we last, in 2023, we opened a satellite, if you will, at Jersey Shore University Medical Center, where advanced cancer care is now being offered through the protocols of John Thurer Cancer Center. We opened up a bone marrow transplant program at Jersey Shore. It's been very, very successful. And, you know, Jersey Shore University Medical Center is our fastest growing hospital within the network, Jeff. And, you know, that's probably logical if you think about it. Since COVID, the population migration from north to south and people living now in Monmouth County and Ocean counties on a permanent basis. So that hospital has really grown significantly. And, you know, it's important that we offer advanced cancer care to folks like that.
Okay. Well, we are out of time unless you want to tell me a little bit about what you're anticipating for the rest of the year, what you're planning for. What do you think? How's 2024 shaping up for you?
Well, I think it's going to be an exciting year. It already is. We have more, as an example, we have more shovels in the ground than any time in our history. I think there's 27 ambulatory care sites that have either just been opened or are being developed now throughout the state. You know, as more and more healthcare gravitates to the ambulatory care settings, it's important that, you know, we provide good access to care closer to people's homes in these ambulatory centers. So excited about that. We're excited about rolling out and implementing a hospital at home program. We started that, in a pilot phase last year. And in 2024, we're going to roll this out throughout our entire health network. We announced a couple new exciting partnerships with One Medical to increase primary care access throughout the state. We're going to be opening up to 20 One Medical Hackensack Meridian Health primary care ambulatory care sites. And we've also announced other partnerships, like with K-Health, which is a virtual primary care provider. You know, more and more people want to receive their care through virtual means. And so this is a great way to do it. So a lot of new partnerships, a lot of expansion, you know, particularly in ambulatory care and home care. And we're going to continue to focus on our hospitals. We did the project, a big project up at Hackensack, the Lena Thurer Pavilion opened last year, you know, the largest expansion project in the history of healthcare in New Jersey. We're going to be doing similar projects at our two other academic medical centers, JFK Medical Center in Edison and Jersey Shore University Medical Center in Neptune. So we're excited about those expansions as well.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to leave it then. Thanks, you. You've been generous with your time. I appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back at some point and give us some more updates about either what's going on in Davos or what's going on at HMH.
Sounds good, Jeff. Thanks. I always appreciate the time with you.
Bob Garrett, CEO of Hackensack Meridian Health. Thanks for joining me, and thank you all for watching. Until next time, stay safe, everyone.